From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Iowa caucuses are 39 days away, and many of the Democratic candidates for president were in Iowa over the weekend, including Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. Here's Biden making a pitch to voters in Perry, Iowa.
Maybe others are willing, but I refuse to accept the proposition that we'll be permanently at war with the other party. What happens to us if that's the case? What happens to us?
Bernie Sanders, who is second behind Biden in national polls, will be in Iowa to ring in 2020. Meanwhile, Andrew Yang is in South Carolina today and tomorrow with about 9 weeks until the primary there.
Joining us now to talk about the presidential race are Kay Henderson. She's news director at Radio Iowa. She's in Des Moines. Hi, Kay.
Happy New Year almost.
Happy New Year almost to you. And Meg Kennard, she's national politics reporter for the Associated Press. She is in Columbia, South Carolina. Meg, good to speak with you.
Hello. Good to speak with y'all.
And Kay, let's start with you. In Iowa, Buttigieg has been at the top of the polls there in that state for a while now. Is he holding on to his momentum?
He is trying, but another person in the so-called moderate lane is making a mad dash to be a competitor. Amy Klobuchar, a neighbor from the north in Minnesota, just wrapped up a 27-county, four-day marathon right before the 25th of December, and she will be back on Friday to wrap up a tour of visits to each of Iowa's 99 counties. People are giving her a look. I think you can't discount the idea that, number one, Iowans like a neighbor. People forget that Barack Obama was a neighbor. He was an Illinois senator. And number two, there is a real desire on a part of many Democrats to support a female candidate. Mm-hmm. And so they have as their options now, basically, Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar.
Well, I'm sure we all remember that moment in the recent debate in Los Angeles when Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg went after it on the issue of fundraisers. Pete Buttigieg was inviting high-dollar fundraisers to a wine cave in California. Now, here's Elizabeth Warren releasing a new ad on Monday in Iowa, honing in on that line of attack.
Our country is deeply divided, but people across this country, Republicans, independents, and Democrats, agree that our top priority has to be fighting corruption in Washington. I'm not doing big dollar fundraisers. I'm not selling ambassadorships to donors. I'm not cozying up to super PACs.
Kay, does that issue resonate in Iowa?
She is hoping that it will. She's arguing that the party will fail in the general election if they nominate someone who is a conventional fundraiser. This, in some ways, reminds me of the 2003-2004 cycle in which you had Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean sort of going after one another, and it gave an opportunity to two senators, both named John, to sort of have a surge at the end in the final 3 weeks of that campaign.
And they both ended up on the ticket, John Kerry and John Edwards as the vice presidential candidate in 2004. Let's skip to South Carolina for a minute. Meg, Biden has the lead there. He's had the lead there for some time. This is a state where the African-American vote is a big part of the Democratic primary electorate. What does the rest of the field look like right now in South Carolina?
The rest of the field is desperately trying to figure out how to make inroads into that longstanding support that Joe Biden has here in South Carolina. As you all will remember, not only was he the vice president in the Obama administration, but he also was the senator for decades before that. And it's during that time that Joe Biden was really on both sides of the aisle with the long-term Republican senator in Strom Thurmond and a Democrat in Fritz Hollings. He really had a long relationship with South Carolina, and voters seem to remember that. But since that also is going back a long time, that does speak to a bit of some of the base that Joe Biden has cultivated here, which does tend to be among older voters. So the rest of the field is trying to not only appeal to the black voters who will have a very determining vote in the South Carolina primary, but they're also trying to capture some of those younger voters that may be interested in the rest of the field. Bernie Sanders has been performing well in South Carolina. Obviously, he came in with a level of name recognition that aside from Joe Biden, nobody else in the field really could even remotely match. But he's been appealing to those younger voters. Elizabeth Warren has been appealing to those younger voters. And both of those candidates have also made inroads within the black voting community. Obviously, there are also some leftovers from Senator Kamala Harris's campaign who are trying to figure out now whom will get their support in the primary. That does represent a significant chunk of African-American voters, and so they are now kind of up for grabs, really, in terms of where they're going to go when South Carolina does vote.
Well, and one candidate who has not been able to catch on, it seems, in South Carolina with African-American voters is Pete Buttigieg, despite being at or near the top of the polls in the first two states. Here he is in a video released by his campaign on Sunday.
Well, it's been a busy few weeks on the campaign trail. We've been in the South discussing health equity and meeting Americans in some of the lowest income areas of South Carolina.
Meg, is he having any success in catching up in the state?
Some of Mayor Pete's numbers in South Carolina have gone up overall and as well among the black voters here. But he also started with zero in those categories, in the black voting category in particular. So Mayor Pete is gaining some sort of traction, but it has been very difficult for him to break through. And he's campaigning to a lot of different constituencies. He's having some small gatherings. He's going to church. He's doing a lot of the things that candidates do in South Carolina to try to get out and meet voters. But for Mayor Pete, it does seem to be a struggle, especially in the black voting community in South Carolina.
What about Cory Booker? He's the only remaining African-American candidate. Why isn't he doing better in South Carolina?
I actually asked Cory Booker that same question when he was in Columbia a few weeks back, and he continues to maintain that he is really, you know, this is the point. We've all been paying attention for a year, but if you ask a lot of these candidates who are lower down in the polls, they say, well, people are just now starting to really think hard about it and to pay attention. And that's one of the answers that Cory Booker has to that question in saying, okay, so I'm still making my case really to a lot of these people. But in black voting groups in particular, he pointed to the fact that he has held recent small group and small events with black women to hear issues specifically important to them, and also to black men to really get to the heart of the issues that are going to play a role in their primary voting decision. So he seems to feel that he is going to be able to break through in some of that. But the clock is ticking, as you note, until the South Carolina primary.
Kay, let's jump back on the campaign bus and go to Iowa again. What about Bernie Sanders? Now, he is in second place in Iowa. He's also second place nationally in the polls.
Right.
Here he is recently in Southern California.
And we are coming together around an agenda that works for working people, not billionaire campaign contributors. And what that agenda says is that if you work 40 hours a week in America, you should not live in poverty.
Now, I guess Bernie Sanders has a big New Year's event. What is it, a Bernie 2020 bash or something on New Year's Eve? What kind of reception is he getting in the state, and what kind of chances does he have?
A lot has been written about how durable Biden's candidacy has been as he's taken, as people like to say, punches. But Sanders' candidacy has been very durable as well. His core of support has stayed with him after his heart attack. He actually seemed to gain a little bit of support. And so it will be interesting to see what happens if down the stretch here, he's able to maintain his level of support. And Elizabeth Warren, who had been, you know, rising in the polls here in Iowa over the summer months, sort of fades.
Meg, do you think that one of the reasons that this field is so split, that nobody has run away in all of the polls, is that Democrats are so focused on beating President Trump that some of them really don't care which one it is that gets the nomination out of a number of them?
There is a lot to that. I mean, voters, no matter where you are, when you ask them what's most important to you in this primary, they say picking someone who can defeat Donald Trump, full stop. So there is a lot of that. I think there's also lingering concern coming from 2016 about the fractiousness that really enveloped the Democratic Party during that primary and then in the aftermath, and really even headed into the convention, all the tension that was there, wondering where the Sanders delegates were going to go. Mm. And as I talk with candidates and voters, too, I ask, you know, how do you feel that this Democratic Party is really going to, whoever the nominee is, maintain that sort of strength and unity going into the general election? And I think there is some concern and some unease, frankly. But overall, Democrats across South Carolina and in all these early voting states, what they keep telling us is We really just need to find that person who is going to be able to get us across the finish line in the general election. And to many of them, at least down here, they see Joe Biden as that person mostly because they feel a level of comfort in being able to think that he can really stand up to Donald Trump in the general election.
And to that end, in this effort to go after Donald Trump, how often does impeachment coming up on the campaign trail?
From a process standpoint, in terms of how it will affect the senators, and sometimes Iowans ask very detailed questions about the actual process of a Senate trial. But in Iowa, at least, it appears that many Democrats have decided their focus should be and has been on the general election in 2020 as the way to remove Donald Trump from office.
That is Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. We've also been speaking with Meg Kinnard, national politics reporter for the Associated Press there in South Carolina. Thanks to both of you and a happy new year.
Thank you.
Right back at you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
This year marked the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, which brought humans to the surface of the moon for the first time. Even in today's world of technology, that event was one of the most remarkable accomplishments ever. Charles Fishman writes about the effort and the lasting impact of the moon landing in his book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. I spoke with Fishman in July on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch, and I asked him, had there ever been anything like that before in U.S. history, when that much money and attention was spent on one thing, in this case, getting a human to land on the moon?
The scale is really unprecedented. 410,000 people worked on Apollo. For every hour that the Apollo astronauts were flying to the moon and walking around and then flying home, for every hour, 1 million hours of work done on Earth. That level of intensity was completely unprecedented.
And very expensive, too, and paid for by the taxpayers.
Well, I don't think it was very expensive. That's one of the, to me, that's one of the myths of Apollo that's worth unpacking. Apollo cost $19.4 billion. There were 2 years of the Vietnam War, each of which cost more than the entire space mission. Apollo lasted from 61 to 72, let's call it $20 billion. From 1961 to 1972, Americans spent $40 billion buying cigarettes.
Right, but that doesn't mean that it was easy for President Kennedy in the beginning to get the money from Congress to pay for what was needed for this.
No. In fact, right at the beginning, there was overwhelming support because Congress was as tired as President Kennedy was of being second to the Russians.
To the Russians.
Right. The Russians did everything first in space for 5 years, and Congress sort of viewed that as losing. Being second was losing. But what's interesting is that Americans were no more patient in the 1960s than we are today. By 1963, by 1964, Congress was like, this is costing a lot of money. When's it going to happen already? At the time he was assassinated, Kennedy was very worried about how to sustain the funding for at that point, what was going to be 4 or 5 more years.
Let's talk about how difficult it was to get a man on the moon. First of all, you know, these days we're all so used to using computers that we can put in our pockets that can do all kinds of things. Back in those days, there weren't computers. These were the first computers, really.
Here's the amazing thing. Any one of us who has an iPhone has more computing power not than flew to the moon. Your iPhone has more processing power than all the computers available to NASA at that time. When Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, it was simply impossible. The tools to do it did not exist. In 8 years, NASA and the 400,000 people working for NASA literally invented the rocket, the spaceship that could land on the moon, the spacesuits. All of that had to be invented from scratch. 10,000 problems had to be solved, and they solved all 10,000.
How connected is our digital world today to the technology that was created in the 1960s for NASA?
You know, I think this is the most important, most overlooked part of Apollo. It unleashed the digital age, and it gets absolutely no credit for that. That little computer that flew the spaceships to the moon and back was an absolute marvel. A small computer in the 1960s was the size of three or four refrigerators lined up. Mm-hmm. And MIT created a computer that was more powerful than the four refrigerators and faster, and that was run by the people who were using it, which was completely unheard of. And that computer was the first computer to use integrated circuits. It was the first computer to use computer chips. And so we start the 60s with no sense of the value of computers and a sense that, if anything, computers were unreliable. Mm-hmm. And we end the 60s with an all-new sense of both the importance of computers and their trustworthiness. We spent a decade watching people at consoles fly to the moon, and also a computer chip industry that understood that in order for computers to be valuable, the chips had to be fast, cheap, and perfect.
And you use the word unreliable. They had to, as you write, build reliability into the computers, because you had to know that there'd be no way, when you were on a mission to the moon, for you to, you know, check to make sure that it was right. It had to be right.
The computers had to work perfectly. There's this sort of moment lost to history. John Glenn's flight in February 1962 was the first orbital flight of a spaceship for the United States. It lasted three orbits, 5 hours. And there was a big IBM computer in mission control in charge of that flight. And the IBM computer failed for 3 minutes. Okay, 3 minutes out of 300, no big deal. That was the most important computer in the world during that 5 hours. Mm-hmm. NASA needed Apollo flight computers. If the computer stopped working for 3 minutes, everybody died. So NASA needed computers absolutely bulletproof, without any possibility of failure.
One of the things that you talk about in this book that I had not given much thought to is the flag that they planted on the moon. And I didn't even think about this, but a flag, of course, wouldn't wave and fly on the moon like it does on land in a windstorm. So how did they make it look so perfect for TV?
The story of the flag is kind of a little bit of a silly side story, but a reminder how hard even simple things were. First of all, NASA hadn't even planned to take a flag. And in April, 12 weeks before we went to the moon, somebody said, how are we going to celebrate this moment? And a technical engineer in Houston, a guy named Jack Kinzler, proposed the plaque, which rode on the lunar module attached to the leg. We came in peace for all mankind. And he came to NASA officials with this very ingenious flag design. And his idea was that there were actually going to be two aluminum poles. There was the one, the vertical one, and it was hinged at the top to a pole that was horizontal. And if you look at the pictures, it's very clear that the flag is, quote unquote, flying, because it's hanging from a horizontal pole as well.
And this matters because there had to be a flag. There was even a question you write about whether they wanted to put a UN flag on the moon, but and members of Congress said absolutely not. It's got to be an American flag.
This was a, you know, Americans spent the money, we will hoist an American flag. For that first moon landing, the raising of the flag and Armstrong and Aldrin alongside it was the front page photo in half the papers of the world, which is kind of amazing given that they almost didn't do it.
Why do you think that putting a man on the moon was so important then? And these days, it seems that NASA is much happier to send a robot. I mean, of course, we do send people into space, but we haven't sent a person to Mars yet, for example. You know, it's difficult, no question. But is it more difficult than it was in 1969 to send a man to the moon?
Not only we haven't sent anybody back to the moon, no one's gone back to the moon since 1972. And once we had done it, there were no economic imperatives to keep going. I think what's really exciting in the world of space today, in fact, is what's going on in near-Earth orbit, what Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and a guy named Robert Bigelow are doing. They're trying to make space flight inexpensive, routine, and unthinkingly safe the way air travel is. What will be really interesting is if you can lower the price of going to space from $100 million a flight to $1 million a flight, you'll unleash the kind of innovation that happened when we went from, you know, modems to high-speed internet.
But don't you think that there was a difference in terms of the inspirational quality in having a person go instead of a robot? And then does that same thing exist today or not any longer? Or is it, it doesn't wow anybody to send a person up there anymore?
There's no question that robots do wonderful science, but human contribution is invaluable and also can't be predicted. There's this wonderful moment when Armstrong and Aldrin on Apollo 11 get back in the lunar module, they unsnap their helmets, and the entire cabin of the lunar module is filled with this smell, the smell of lunar dirt, sort of like burned charcoal, or Aldrin said, the smell of the air after a fireworks show. No robot could tell you that the moon had a smell. We haven't gone back because there hasn't been either an economic or political imperative. And it is really hard. If it were easy, we would have gone back. Mars is 100 times harder than the moon. It's the difference between traveling for 3 days and traveling for 3 years.
Right, but our computers are much better than they were back then. Could probably handle it. Charles Fishman, you have written about water. You have written about Walmart. Now this story of the first moon landing. How do you get so excited about these different topics?
What I love is to try and understand how people get their work done. And, you know, in 8 years, we invented spaceflight. We invented all the tools we needed, from miniaturized computers to space food. I wanted to understand what it was about the spirit at that moment and the commitment to sort of try and appreciate what we can bring forward from that. Every single day of the 4 years I spent working on this, I discovered some little surprise. There were only three people authorized to fold the parachutes for Apollo space capsules, and they were so important to NASA that NASA forbid them to ever ride in the same car together so that they
just
couldn't
just in case they got in a crash.
So they couldn't all be injured at the same
wow.
time. When you find a story like that every day, you sort of think, this is going to be something people love to learn about.
That is Charles Fishman, author of the book One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. We spoke in July. This year marked the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. Members of Israel's conservative Likud party are voting in a primary election today, deciding the fate of their embattled leader, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He faces corruption charges, and he failed twice this year to put together a coalition in parliament. If he wins today's primary, he faces another parliamentary election in March. Joining us now is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we're hearing that Netanyahu is expected to win this primary, but who is this person challenging him for the leadership of the Likud party?
His name is Gideon Saar. He's a former cabinet minister, and for years he's been building up a support base within the party for this very moment to challenge Netanyahu for party leadership. He's been trying to show that he's more right-wing than Netanyahu. For instance, he has said very squarely that he's against any kind of Palestinian state. But really, his main campaign pitch is that he can win national elections and Netanyahu cannot. He's saying that Netanyahu failed to form a government after two inconclusive elections this year, and so he will not be able to win a third time in national elections this March. Likud's main rivals, the centrist Blue and White Party, has said that they would form a government with the Likud party just as long as Netanyahu doesn't lead it, because Netanyahu faces corruption charges for his dealings with businessmen.
Interesting. So he's saying that the way out of this impasse is to give the reins over to him. But it sounds like, based on the polling, that Netanyahu's going to win today. So what does it say about Netanyahu that he hasn't been able to put together a coalition twice and that he's being challenged from within his own party?
Well, it says that he's a weakened leader, which is really a remarkable thing to say for Israel's longest-serving prime minister. I mean, the Likud party itself has only had four leaders since the party was formed in the 1970s. Its supporters tend to stand by their leader and not to vote their leader out. So this time around, Netanyahu is facing a serious contender, really the most serious challenge to his leadership from within his own party since he became prime minister a decade ago. And, you know, we're talking about a towering figure. Netanyahu used to win election after election. People called him King Bibi, and he's not looking as strong today.
You were at the polls today, Daniel. What has the mood been like among voters? They must be exhausted with all of this voting that they have to do.
Well, I must say that the Likud members who were at the polling place in Jerusalem where I visited were really fired up. Every voter I spoke to but one was voting for Netanyahu. The one exception was a woman who seemed to be a Saar supporter, but she seemed to be too nervous to say that out loud. His supporters, his most enthusiastic ones, think that Netanyahu can still hang on. He is expected to win this primary. The question is by how much, because if Saar gets a large chunk of the vote, maybe 25, even 30% of the vote, that's a sign that there's a crack in the party and that the party has a new up-and-coming leader in the wings.
By the way, has President Trump gotten involved in any way in this primary?
Very interestingly, he's remained on the sidelines and he's been silent. Some observers here say Trump doesn't like a loser and Netanyahu has lost or not conclusively won election after election this year. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has spoken in favor of Israel, and Netanyahu and Pompeo have spoken. But as far as we know, Netanyahu and Trump haven't.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. Thanks, Daniel.
You're welcome.
The new film 1917 is set in the trenches of World War I. Two young British soldiers, Lance Corporals Blake and Schofield, played by Dean Charles Chapman and George MacKay, are assigned a terrifying mission. Their general orders them to leave the trenches and sneak past enemy lines. Their job is to deliver a message to a British colonel who is planning an attack against the Germans that is doomed to fail.
Deliver this to Colonel Mackenzie. It is a direct order to call off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, it will be a massacre. We will lose two battalions.
Throughout the film, the camera seems to follow Blake and Schofield continuously in one single shot, never giving the viewer a chance to look away from the danger ahead. That was a deliberate choice of the writer-director, Sam Mendes, but it required the technical mastery possessed by my next two guests. Cinematographer Roger Deakins, welcome.
Okay, pleasure.
And Lee Smith, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So this film was not shot all in one take, but it certainly does feel like it. Roger Deakins, start with you. How in the world did you make this movie?
Well, we had a long prep process. Sam and I just discussing the style, the feel of it, and then months of rehearsals with the actors to really figure out what each shot was. So, you know, you break it down and it sort of like gradually kind of gets worked out.
And what about the lighting? Because, you know, it's supposed to take place over the course of a single day, but in fact, the lighting changed all the time and it was mostly done outside.
Well, that was the hardest thing of the day, exteriors. You can't light because you're basically doing 360 degrees. But also, I mean, just in terms of the mood of the piece and, you know, technically matching from one shot to another, we had to shoot in clouds. So that was a bit of an anxious moment on the first day of the shoot when there wasn't a cloud in the sky and we couldn't shoot anything. That was a bit anxious.
So what did you do?
Well, we rehearsed a lot, and then the second day we got a lovely cloud cover and we shot 2 days' work in one day. So that's how it went during the shoot. If the sun was out, we wouldn't shoot. We'd rehearse and just wait. And a lot of time was spent watching the sky, waiting for a cloud to come along that was long enough that we could do a shot under. Huh.
Well, I want to play some sound from a scene when one of the main characters, Schofield, who's played by the actor George MacKay, is sprinting through the darkness through a French village, and German soldiers are firing at him as he weaves through the buildings. You know, I white-knuckled my way through this entire film because I think as an audience member, you're kind of moving through the trenches and the battlefield almost like eye level of the actors as they move in forward motion through the scene. Using this technique, I mean, how do you think it heightens the experience for the audience, Richard Deakins?
Well, I think it's a very particular story. It takes place in real time, and you're with these two characters for the whole time. And you want the audience to experience what they're experiencing and see what they see. You know, at no time does the camera see something that the characters don't see.
How'd the actors respond?
They kind of loved it because, I mean, there was a lot of technical work, just working out their moves in relationship to the camera. But once they got that down, they could get into the character. They could actually be that character for 8 minutes, knowing, or up to 8 minutes, and knowing that there wasn't going to be a cut. You know, I think they really enjoyed it.
Well, Lee Smith, let's bring you in because you're the editor of this film, which means it's your job to take those 8 minute scenes and then put them together to make it all look like it's one shot. How are you able to do that?
Well, there was a lot of, as Roger was saying, there was a huge amount of preparation and rehearsal went into this making of this film. So all of these, let's call them transitions, were well and truly thought about and then executed on the set. So, you know, my job was not just to put the two shots together, which I had to do in a big hurry, because each choice informed how the setup was for the next shot. Really, it was about checking performance, talking to Sam on a daily basis, checking pacing, rhythms, the accumulative effect as you start putting the film together.
But how did you find those transitions? As I watched the film, there's only one time when you fade to black where you can tell there's some sort of shift. But otherwise, you really can't tell. What techniques did you use to move from take to take?
Black magic.
You can't tell us. The magician never
Dark
tells.
Dark arts. I think editing's called the invisible art, right?
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. But again, it's these were highly planned. They came to us from the set with all the best intention in the world. So really, you could only do this film with that level of pre-production and thought because if the light doesn't match, if the continuity's not right on the actors, even if the performances are not matching, if you don't have a director who's got the entire film in his head, for example, it just would have been a rolling disaster.
Right. Did you ever worry that if you didn't pull it off exactly right, that the technique would be a distraction and maybe even, you know, could be seen as something of a gimmick?
I was more worried about the accumulative pacing issues as far as really you're building the film in a linear sense. And Sam and I had discussed this at great length before, saying you don't have traditional post-production techniques that I can apply to the movie. It has to be on a daily basis. You literally have to make this film day by day. And if there's a problem, then it's my job to talk to Sam and say, you know, something's not right.
Well, here's another scene from the film. Blake and Schofield are watching in the distance three planes that are in a dogfight, not far actually from where they're standing.
Who's winning?
Us, I think. 2-on-1.
They got him.
And you can hear the plane slowly getting closer and closer. It eventually crashes at their feet. I will not say what happens after that, but just, you know, walk me through what it took to pull off an effect like that using this method of filmmaking.
Obviously, this is a combination of elements that are filmed separately and then composited together, you know. Whether it's digital effects or mechanical effects, you're using all the state-of-the-art techniques that are available to you.
Yeah, that was an interestingly complex sequence, even though it looks easy. It was all mapped out and shot, and as Roger's saying, the planes were put in later, and there were separate elements that went into that, both live action and CGI. After the thing was shot, we were moving those planes around to exactly match eye lines and speed and on all that sort of thing. So hopefully it looks effortless, but there was a lot of energy went into that and just a lot of precision.
You know, we have been talking about the technical side of making this film, but its heart is a story about two scared young men trying to cross an absolutely terrifying scene in World War One. The director, Sam Mendes, dedicated this film to his grandfather, who was a messenger in that war. And, you know, this story was loosely based on the stories that he heard from his grandfather over the years. Talk to me about the human side of this story. And Roger, let's start with you.
I think that the strength of the film is that it's not a history lesson, that it is this personal story about these two characters in this, like, appalling situation. And you think about those young guys that left Britain to go to fight on the continent. Most of them were sort of country boys that had never been abroad before. So, you know, it must have been all that more terrifying to be sort of in such a different world, you know?
Hmm. Lee, was it important to you to get this film just right for that reason?
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever you're dealing with a war story, you know, you have to show respect. A lot of people lost their lives. And I think, you know, with all of the detail that went into the making of this film, you know, from the production design, you know, to the dialogue, keeping a sense of reality, I think, was incredibly important. And in the end, it's a story of bravery and doing the right thing and trying to save 1,600 men from slaughter. So in the end, it's just a very simple story.
That's editor Lee Smith and cinematographer Roger Deakins. The film is 1917, and it is a feat. Thank you both very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And if you want to see more, we've got the trailer at hereandnow.org.
As scientists try to mitigate the effects of climate change, the UN is recommending biochar. It's a form of charcoal made from natural matter like straw, shells, wood chips, or even sewage sludge. And it can trap carbon in the ground for centuries. In New England, many entrepreneurs, farmers, and gardeners are embracing biochar because it improves soil quality and keeps agricultural runoff out of waterways. John Kalish has our story.
You make biochar by baking organic matter at about 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit with little or no oxygen.
This is good biochar. There's a number of ways you can tell.
Bob Wells manufactures biochar kilns in Massachusetts.
There's no brown inside. There's no white on the outside. There's no ash. Another good indicator with this that it's good char, you can listen to it. It clinks when you drop it. If you don't hear that, it's probably not cooked enough.
Wells uses biochar on his small Cape Cod farm, where he says it's done wonders for the sandy soil there.
Well, I've been using it since 2005, and the difference in the soil is very dramatic. It's gone from sand to being this rich, dark loam that produces a lot more plants than the old sandy soil did.
About 160 miles away in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, Doug Clayton makes biochar in a homemade system that consists of three steel drums and a 4-foot-long chimney. Clayton fills one drum with wood chips and another drum with kindling. An electric fan regulates the speed of the combustion. Clayton's small backyard rig does the same thing that big industrial biochar plants do. It utilizes gases created in the cooking process as a fuel source.
I spent years perfecting this model. This process made it cleanly so that you didn't make a lot of smoke.
And few carbon emissions. In addition, the heat produced during biochar production can be captured and used to generate energy. In Tennessee, a multi-million-dollar biochar plant takes wood waste and produces electricity. Hugh McLaughlin, chief technology officer of a Massachusetts startup called NextChar, says these energy savings are likely to benefit American farmers who grow, say, corn or soybeans.
A lot of fossil energy applications can be displaced by energy from biochar making. If you had to dry crops and you were buying natural gas or propane to dry the crops, you could use this waste heat coming off the biochar production for that heating application. So you would displace the fossil fuel use.
McLaughlin's company recently completed a pilot project making biochar from almond and walnut shells in California's Central Valley. He notes that because biochar extends water efficiency, it could help in places where water is scarce. And biochar may be helpful as both an agricultural and environmental tool in the Northeast. A plant currently under construction in New Jersey will turn sewage sludge into biochar, and a small startup in Vermont is demonstrating biochar's ability to keep agrochemicals out of waterways. Green State Biochar's homemade kiln is housed in a greenhouse with walls made from wooden shipping pallets. The company recently won a second grant from the State Agriculture Department to mitigate the impact of phosphorus in Vermont's waterways. Its biochar has filtered out more than 90% of the phosphorus at two dairy farms and will soon be used on more Vermont farms.
We just want to make some clean water.
That's Roger Pion, a co-founder of Green State Biochar, which buys wood chips from a local sawmill to use as feedstock. Some environmentalists worry that emerging carbon credit markets for biochar production in Europe will create an incentive to cut down forests. But a Maine farmer named David McDaniel has demonstrated a way to harvest wood sustainably using a centuries-old woodland management technique known as coppicing. He made biochar from a tree known as the speckled alder.
We cut this alder that was about 9-10 feet tall. We cut it and we chipped it on the spot. And then we dried those chips in a solar kiln. And then that became our feedstock.
The alder tree's roots sent up new shoots that grew and can eventually be harvested again. McDaniel has a USDA grant to develop a coppicing plantation, which he plans to harvest and use to make more biochar. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Well, one more thing as we close out this hour. Peter, people across parts of the Middle East and Southeast Asia witnessed an annular solar eclipse today. Sounds kind of like the sound of a crowd viewing the total solar eclipse. But this was a crowd in Singapore where the moon covered 94% of the sun. This kind of eclipse is known as the Ring of Fire because the moon covers the center of the sun, leaving a bright ring around the edge. The pictures are pretty spectacular. And by the way, the next solar eclipse is on June 21st next year. Okay. But sadly, you won't be able to see it here. It will be visible over a large swath of Africa and Asia.
We will miss that one.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.